Welcome to the Modern Spirituality Show. I'm Ben Decker, here with my friend, Annalyn McCord.
Hello.
Annalyn, where to even fucking begin? We have so many things we could talk about.
Tell him he starts his spirituality podcast episode.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Where to fucking begin?
Where to fucking begin? That's like a very, that's the oldest spiritual question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an actual terminology in these different spiritual practices that you teach, isn't it?
I mean, this, that articulated that exact way is sort of like a rough translation of the oldest question.
Yes.
Where to begin?
Where to begin?
Yeah. Okay. So look, you've been in the entertainment industry for 20 years. We met both working in that industry, me on the PR executive side, you as talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always loved acting, taking acting classes, gotten a lot out of it, have really appreciated things that I've heard you say in interviews and in the course of our relationship about acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know you have a spiritual background. And you've had a spiritual awakening, and you have like a very open connection to, you know, the divine, as you understand.
Yeah.
So I'd love to just like bring you in and just like have you share a little bit about where those intersect.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting how the process that an actor goes through is in a lot of ways, maybe not even a metaphor. It's almost the exact same thing as a spiritual awakening, at least from my point of view. And I've always said that everyone should take an acting class. Oh, I have said that for years and years, just because the first thing that you are required to do when you start, it's like, okay, bare your soul, do the most embarrassing tasks and do it up in front of all the class. And, you know, if you have even an iota of shame, you did it wrong. So right. If you break that down and it seems like, oh my gosh, you know, just, okay, well, the actors are a special group of people. We are very special people, like extra special, like need help special. But It's actually really interesting if you think about it, how many things in your life can you get up on a stage and do without shame?
Right.
How many things in front of another person can you stand up and do with absolutely no shame? We have so much shame entrenched in our cells and our body and the culture and society. And it's something that people are proud of, but people will say with incredulity, he has no shame. You know, that's actually a lovely thing. You should have no shame. You should never feel shame ever in your life. And people often come at me like, well, what about, and then they go into the taking accountability response. But I love Brené Brown because she very much differentiates shame and guilt. Guilt is something that makes you realize, oh, that hurt someone's feelings. I shouldn't do that. That made you feel bad or upset or uncomfortable. The shame is, I am bad and I make people feel uncomfortable because of who I intrinsically am as a being. And right. Therefore, I can never actually get out of the loop of causing people issues or doing things perceived as bad because I am bad versus I did something that was bad. And it's interesting because we put this onto our quote unquote villains in the world.
Right.
And they are not allowed to ever be forgiven of their transgressions. They are forever vilified in our memory. And in acting, when you play villains, rule number one, if you judge your character, if you call a quote unquote villain a villain, you have just lost yourself that role. And even if you're playing it, you're an actor who now sucks at the job you're doing, because the second that you judge what you are choosing for that character, you ruin the
you lose connection to the being.
Well, you lose that, but you ruin the truth and the authenticity of what an individual who expresses like that feels. They're not thinking in their brain, I am a villain and do villainy things. They think, my environment is so messed up and I'm tired of being on the receiving end of all the messed upness of it all, right? So I'm going to be the one who gets my power back. And it's typically a narrative of power plays. So even just the beginning of, even just the simplest form of reasons for why to do an acting class, but why, when you look at acting and a spiritual awakening, they start to almost become simultaneous. Right. Or not simultaneous, but
synonymous.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I also just the whole journey of, you know, an overnight success, 10 years in the making. Right. Also the same for spiritual awakening.
Okay, so a lot of us think about this idea. We hear people talk about and we read about it in all the scriptures, okay, in all the different traditions. There's this idea of divine intervention, spontaneous transformation, miracles, immediate spiritual awakening. And there's this narrative in a lot of myths, a lot of legends, a lot of scriptures, and even in community, there's this narrative that everything changed and it's sort of like happily ever after, you know? But what you just said is so important. So I want to like reemphasize it and like tee you up to hit that one more time. You said,
oh, literally teed me up and was like, go. What did I say? I said with acting, an overnight success is 10 years in the making. That's a phrase that we say in Hollywood. An overnight success is 10 years in the making. So an overnight awakening is 10 years in the making. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I had to go back to the script in my head. And
I was like, oh, I forgot. No, I'm just kidding. But
that's because you're neurodivergent.
Yeah, it's because I'm neurodivergent. So thank you for your patience. Okay, but the thing that really, really hits is like that. First of all, a lot of us have heard that expression, overnight success is 10 years in the making.
Minimum.
Minimum, right, right. And so you've actually been in the industry for, I want to say 20.
Professionally for 20 plus years. I started acting when I was 9, doing, you know, all the little local community theater school plays and all that stuff. So I've wanted this and loved this and enjoyed this and dreamed of this for 27 years. But professionally I've been doing it for 21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible. And you have had tons of success in different ways. I'm not going to go into that. She hates when I talk like that. So we're not going
to, I told him if he does that while I'm here, I'm going to get up and leave the room. So he wants me to stay on the podcast.
Yeah. I'd like you to stay. So I'm just going to like fully honor that boundary.
Thank you.
No that's means sweet. No, folks. No means no. Okay. So,
I did do a spiritual clearing on my resistance to it, though, in the bathroom just now, just so you know.
Okay, well, and I...
Because I did acknowledge after the fact, once I got done with my ego yelling at you for doing that to me, I literally told him, don't ever do this to me again. He'd listed pretty much my entire career, all accolades I've received, but it went on and on. And he thinks it went on for a minute 45. It was definitely 6 minutes long. It was so uncomfortable. And I realized after our conversation, once he had agreed that he would never do this to me again, or that I could leave the room if he does, I then went in the restroom and was like, do I have resistance that's not for my highest good? And I'm getting like higher guidance. It's like, yeah, boo. And you got so much resistance on this. So then I was like, oh, you're irrevocably denied permission for this to remain in my body. And so I cleared it, but okay. I cleared what doesn't serve. Yeah, it's still there.
Obviously, I respect you as a friend, and I'm going to continue to honor that forever.
I still don't like revel in the idea of it, but right. I have.
Released, well, I only
there was like blood pressure rising
right.
that I think I released. So
okay, cool. Well, that's
hallelujah.
Good. And the only thing I wanted to really mention right now is that you have had a lot of success over 20 years.
Yes.
You know, and so like to honor that idea that archetypal fact that overnight success is 10 years in the making. And it's true across the board in anything, even, you know, there was an article I read recently that was like, this guy started his company and out of nowhere, and he paid off his loans and blah, blah, blah. You look into it, it's like he inherited a $2 million condo from his parents. He went to the same Ivy League school as his dad. It's like, no, that was like 100 years in the making, bro. Yeah. You know, it's like,
yes,
no,
it was I left the trailer park. I moved to New York at 15. I studied acting in New York. I moved to LA when I was 18. I didn't know anyone but my agent. And I was actually, that's actually wonderful because I actually had an agent.
Right, exactly.
Some people arrive and don't even have that. So I was already, you know, off to a good start, thankfully, because I had met my agent when she was a casting director, and I was saving up money by doing modeling, which was another blessing that I was able to do because I had zeromoneys.com. Like I literally was like, subletting someone's futon in a one, you know, studio apartment. And I was going to say one bedroom, but no, it wasn't one bedroom. New York is so expensive. So I did not have any lovely nepotism, yummy, yummy nepotism to lean on. I didn't know anybody. And so I really was at ground zero, started from the bottom. Now we, And I am grateful for that journey.
Right.
And I also am grateful for nepotism.
Right.
Because now that I do have relationships in the industry, they think of me because of building a relationship.
Well, I don't think it counts as nepotism. If you have a real relationship from actually being a professional on set, you have, like, I'm not listing accolades. I'm talking about like professional stamina.
Yeah.
Like you turn things in more or less on time. You know, you show up on time.
Yeah.
You look the part. You get your script down to a T.
That part's not true.
Well, when I was on set with you,
he's so lovely.
When I was, the time that I was on set with you, what I observed is what I'll say. The one time I saw.
Get your script down insinuates that I study, which I do not. I wing it like any good
angel
grammar actress, like who likes to cram before the exam. But I am grateful to good genetics that allow me a photographic memory and allow me to do that. But it is a big part of my
good
process.
Genetics, trauma, all the things that cause all that photographic memories.
but my process is born out of that. So one big part of my process is that if I were to have my script down, it would actually ruin my talent.
Well, that's really what I mean. It's like, you know, your instrument.
My process is authenticity is born out of spontaneity and instinct for me. This is not necessarily true for, I mean, my ex Dominic Purcell, who I absolutely worship at the feet of when it comes to talent and his gift as an actor, his gifts as an actor. He has a very different process where he spends weeks in advance. And unless it's fully coded in his brain, all the words, he can't fully get to that next space of deep authenticity because he's worried that he won't know the words. Mm. So everyone has a different process for it. But this parallels with spiritual awakening or a spiritual journey. No teacher, no person who's had an amazing experience spiritually speaking, no individual, because we are individuals, even as we are in the oneness, no one can tell you what your spiritual process should look like. You are the only one who knows. And no teacher can teach you. No healer can heal you. That's not real. A great teacher and a great healer awakens the teacher and the healer within you. And a great acting coach awakens the ability within the actor to realize themselves. A great director does the same thing. These themes are, you have the answers within you. You have the ability within you. Yes, someone can say certain things that give you that new neural network, that aha moment, that epiphany that occurs and the brain creates a new network that sends you on the next level of your path. But you have to be open to receive it. You have to co-create to be open to it. So that for me I left drama school, which my teacher was very mad at me because he wanted to teach me. And I left a year before the program ended because I had an opportunity to come to LA and I wasn't going to say no to what that could be. And he's like, you're never going to work. You're never going to have any longevity because you couldn't stick this out. And he like went off on me. And I knew that, I mean, I didn't know at the time, I was kind of like, screw you, motherfucker. Because I was 18, but I, in thinking back on it, he was that older, wiser individual who wanted to impart what was his experience, that if you don't stick things out, maybe you end up as an acting coach and not an actor. Right. Not that that was his path, but maybe that's what he was trying to share with me. And I was the 18 year old neophyte who was like, yeah, whatever, Mr. Hierophant, like I'm out, right. But the crossover, if you look at Joseph Campbell's teachings, who the author of Hero with a Thousand Faces, and he takes you on the hero's journey. It is the soul's journey.
Right.
And there's so much crossover being able to, I can so easily honor the shadow of my villainous characters. And I've played many of them. And then I couldn't even give a hug to the shady part of myself because she was terrible and horrible and deserved to be crucified every 5 seconds in my mind, just replaying abuses to myself with all these self-judgment expressions in my brain. And if I really was able to integrate my career and what I did every single day with my own existence as a person, I would have been a lot kinder to myself in very dark periods of my life specifically. But where I am now is I'm playing the most important role I'll ever do, which is the role of Anna Lynn. Mm-hmm. And I've completely detached from my identification with Anna Lynn as me. And now I'm the soul that likes playing the character Anna Lynn, just like Anna Lynn plays the character of whatever my latest film is or show. And if we were capable of thinking of our bodies and our form of the five senses expression and kind of what we identify with as the human part of us, if we were able to see that as a role we're playing versus who we are, we could change everything. Mm-hmm. In one moment, in one instant, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what changes is our capacity to offer ourselves grace. Mm-hmm. It is so easy for me to have just understood grace for my characters. Mm-hmm. I'm searching for every nuanced moment where I can show their pain and their tragic side and the beauty of someone, who's just still struggling to stay alive, but comes off just terribly pretty much at every angle. And then if that was me identified with Anna Lynn as me, the body, and me, the identified with human self, it's like, how dare you fuck up anything? Like, how dare you make a mistake? How dare you say this? Like, let me replay it 9,000 times for the rest of eternity. And it's just so unkind.
Right.
And if I knew how to be a human as well as I know how to be an actress, mm-hmm. I think throughout my life, I would have had a lot easier go struggling to keep my head above water with all that was already confronting me in the sense of what was trapped in my body, the trauma that was trapped in my body, the toxic narrative of growing up in a culture that puts onto you a lot of notions that I don't agree with personally. And they were made to be a part of my life for a long time until I had the wherewithal to acknowledge, become conscious of them because they are unconscious processes before they are able to be cleared. But I think that if I was able to overlay my acting world with my Anna Lynn life earlier, I would have really learned a lot from me, mm-hmm. which this is me awakening the healer within me awakening the teacher within me. And we need the Ben Deckers of the world and another teacher of mine, Carolina Goldberg, who who open up the space with teaching for that teacher to arise within the student. And so those moments are crucial. The moments that I had in drama school with Terry Knickerbocker, my good old teacher, I needed some of those moments mostly because I met my wifey best friend, my best friend of forever since I was 17 years old. But I also witnessed myself with other people witnessing me, with a teacher witnessing me and reflecting back to me something. One of the things he said in class was, see, Annalyn is attached to her reason for why she needs to complete this task. She's connected to her story. She's connected to her reason. This character is fully embodied because she's so connected to her story. Mm-hmm. That was all a lie. Because I actually completely improvised the story. I didn't do my homework at all. Back to me, the cram before the exam. I completely forgot I was supposed to do a task. I'm on the train heading to class. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't do any of the homework. I thought I was supposed to do it. And when he asked me, I made up this whole story about my grandmother's brooch that's been passed down through the generations, and I was going to wear it to prom, but now it's broken and I have to put it back together before my grandmother gets here and she's going to freak out on me. And he thought I was so connected to my story. I was so afraid that he was going to find out that I was lying through this and totally winging it. And it turns out lying and winging it worked out really well for me in the early days of my career. And this is yet another thing that I'm seeing a parallel with my spiritual journey, is in the beginning of my acting career, it was lying and improvising, because in life I was a liar and I was always improvising every moment because I was scared to be who I really was. And then I had a moment where I got really honest with myself, and I went through a few layers of spiritual awakening, and I started to be really real. And then I got on a show again, and I called my ex, who I was talking about. We were together on and off for 10 years. So it was a long period of my career was with him. And I called Dom, and I'm like, Dom, I forgot how to act. And he's like, Emma, you didn't forget how to act. And I'm like, no, I don't know what to do. I'm on this show in Dallas. I was on Dallas in Dallas, and I'm in the hotel room pacing and panicking that I've forgotten how to act, because I had with him, he was such an honest person, such an authentic person, so painfully authentic, brutally authentic, but he inspired that in me. And then I became this honest person, but then I couldn't lie anymore. So I couldn't do what I did in that class with Terry Knickerbocker and be like my grandmother and the thing, yeah, because I was actually in real time telling the truth now as a human. So my acting career had to evolve with the authentic self I was discovering within me. So this kind of the spiritual awakening was helping the acting, and the acting was helping the spiritual awakening on an unconscious level, at least. So just the parallels are fascinating to me.
Big time. It sounds almost like you've been really open on previous episodes here and also on a lot of different platforms about trauma you experienced growing up. So we don't need to go into it here, but it seems to me almost like the acting served as perhaps an escape until, correct me if I'm wrong, until it served as like a channel for.
Yeah. I think there are a few steps in between as well. If you look at Joseph Campbell's hero's journey,
right,
it, part of what he's lays out for you are all the characters that the hero meets throughout the hero's journey, right? So the mentor and the ally and the challenger and the gatekeeper.
Right.
So all of these wonderful themes that are remarkably spiritual and mystical are crucial for the formula of a script to be written. And everyone in Hollywood knows you, the Joseph Campbell or the Christopher Vogel. Christopher Vogel took Joseph Campbell's kind of very, very expansive hero's journey and brought it down from 17, I think, to 13 steps. Mm-hmm. But the archetypes remain the same. So at these different stages throughout my career, I was the mentor to the hero Annalyn. My acting me was the mentor, or the ally, or the challenger, or the gatekeeper to the Annalyn hero's journey that was being lived out as my soul experience on earth. And then my soul experience on earth was elevating my capacity to perform, because now I wanted a deep moment in every moment of every, and I wanted to communicate from my soul to my co-star. And I started doing these crazy things where I'm like looking in their eyes and I'm like, I am inviting your soul to elevate to the highest possible. And they come and we get finished the scene and they're like, I felt so connected to you. Like, that, did you feel that? And I was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally felt that. I'm so, tell me more about what you felt specifically.
Well, it's so interesting the way you're paralleling like the spiritual journey and acting, but also real life. That's actually a really good way to cultivate intimacy in your real relationships. It's like,
yeah, I do it to people very weirdly. I'm like, I'll tell my friends at coffee, I'm like, look at my eyes. And they're like, oh no, not again.
Oh, but I think it's so sweet when you do it, you know? And I think it's also like, there's this huge need, just like we have to like increase our ability to love ourselves, love each other, communicate that love in a lot of different ways. There was like that classic book, The Five Love Languages, so that we could, you know, so I think that was a really important book because we all learned, oh, there are actual different ways. So whether you believe like that idea of five separate languages or just like infusing different moments with like the loving thought and the loving intention.
Yeah.
It was a huge awakening from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like, that's what you're doing. Only you're doing it sort of like really intentionally, I think, you know,
I invite
your soul to its highest vibrational expression.
Yeah.
For the highest secret.
And I definitely have I definitely have a British accent. So
glad you're now.
To invite your soul to the highest possible elevation point. Would you like to rise with me?
Okay, speaking of that, my fourth book, Modern Spirituality, is narrated by a British man.
Because why wouldn't you? Spirituality sounds better with a British person. Actors that are British are better than Americans. I'm sorry to all my American friends, but like literally Commonwealth trained actors, just, I don't know, you guys just, you're better than we are.
Yeah, I was just like, wow, should I take this personally? And I was like, no, it's not personal.
It's just British.
You're American.
Yeah.
It's not personal.
No.
Okay, so there's something else that you said that I thought was really interesting that I wanted to ask you about. Actually, only if you're comfortable. I was kind of curious, you mentioned Dominic. You were together for 10 years.
Yeah.
He's engaged now.
He is. Is there a question?
I guess that's the question. That's the question. I mean, he's engaged. I mean, you were together for a long time. I know that you're not together. You've shared that you have so much respect and everything. I think that, first of all, I think that's really interesting to me, is because a lot of people, especially in the entertainment industry, can't handle the challenges of a breakup and what that really brings up, and still have like a respect for the other person. So you clearly still have like a lot of respect and compassion and love and positive feelings towards Dominic. And so how do you feel about him getting,
you know,
engaged?
I think that the reason this is something that everyone thinks is supposed to be a certain way, and when I then don't feel that way, my friends kind of look at me like I'm just lying. Because we're so conditioned. No, I know I'm not lying, which is all I care about. I don't give a shit if anybody else does.
Yeah.
But I and Dom knows that I am so happy for him. But that's we're the two that matter in that equation.
Right.
But more than that, and I think to, you know, kind of keep it in theme with your amazing podcast, is we've been sold a lie. Right. We've been sold an unbelievably long-standing lie that everybody buys into, and it's a lie. It's a lie that we should be with someone forever. Mm-hmm. And it's true if you want to.
Right.
it's a lie that we should never get divorced. And it's true that you shouldn't if you don't want to. It's a lie that we should ever think it's even possible to truly love someone and then stop. Right. That's a lie.
Right.
So you never love that person at all, not real love, or you love them forever. That's the truth. And the way to look at that from a standpoint of actuality is to look at the love of you have with a pet or something, you know, like we can really understand the unconditional love. Well, the irony of calling love unconditional.
Exactly.
It's love is unconditional and everything else is bullshit.
Right.
So if you're calling it love, you just have it mislabeled. What it is either attention or approval or any of these other things, admiration, infatuation, whatever, but it ain't love. Love and unconditionality are synonymous with each other. So to say unconditional love is redundant. It's right. Completely redundant. So I love Dom because I actually love him.
Right.
So what does that mean? That means that I am so grateful for the 10 years of the life education and the lessons and the joy and the yumminess, and he's so gorgeous and sexy, and all the things that I derived from our relationship. And I love that he's being loved again in a new way, and that he's found connection in a new partnership, and that he's hopefully going to elevate who he is into the next level of the Dominic Purcell era. And I love all of that. And I know his daughters, they wouldn't let him be with someone who doesn't love daddy. So I'm not worried at all. But this to me is truth. And we've been sold a lie. And Gary Zukav is one of the teachers that opened the teacher within me to discover this belief within myself. Cause I always had, and it's so funny, I had my palm randomly read this weekend when I went up to my friend's house. Her mom was Korean and she reads palms. Now it's like, well, here's my palm. She goes, oh, lots of trouble with relationship. Very difficult for you. And I was like, yeah, anyway, she was like, very, very difficult for you. But it's been beautiful because I mean, maybe I've got a little Teresa Avila vibe, but like, I see the lessons in all of the hurt and the suffering and the pain and the misunderstandings and that coming full circle. And Gary Zukav talks about this in Spiritual Partnership, right, which is one of his amazing, I mean, I've read this book a gazillion times, but I never subscribed to the whole marriage thing. And I didn't really, I thought I was 9 years old and I was like, I'm never getting married. I'm never having kids. And it kind of like stuck until like last week. But until yesterday when I got my palm read, she's like, you're going to get married. And I was like, I am. I've never really planned on that, Uma. But she said this, and she showed me how this, like the M is supposed to be perfect on the hand, but I've got like a two-prong situation going on. And I was like, I mean, I could have told you that myself, but all right. But I read Spiritual Partnerships by Gary Zukav and it changed everything for me because finally I found the truth and I had known it. I just didn't have words for it. And he opened that up within me because I was resistant to the notion of marriage because I didn't know what I was trying to express that I want.
Right.
And what I want is a spiritual partnership. And it's incredibly different. Spiritual partnership is exactly how I feel about Dom. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful that I got to love and challenge your soul for this period of time. And now that I'm no longer the one that challenges your soul at this level, and you can go on to a new space and be challenged in a new way that honors your soul, I release you. Mm-hmm. And same, you know, not that necessarily this is his philosophy, but right. This is for me, the way I saw the relationship. I see the relationship. Now I get to step into the next era of my life where I'm challenged to a new level by the partner that I am bringing in, and his energy and his power and his expression will offer me what my next phase is about. And I will step up to the plate and offer that to him. And there's no attachment to an outcome of forever, which is ludicrous. I mean, I used to get fear of commitment about signing a TV show contract for 6 years. I'm like, oh God, my agents are like, you have to do the screen test. Like, it's not like a done deal yet. And I'm like, no, I can't do this. I can't do this. Fear of commitment, FOC problems. So the idea of signing on a marriage license, like until death do us part, excuse me, I don't fucking know if I want to live and die with you. I like you right now. Like, right. I love Jim Carrey. He's like, marriage is so creepy. Whoever thought of marriage is a total creep. Like, I love you so much. I'm going to get the government involved so you can't leave.
Right.
I was like, same. And I didn't understand my reticence to the notion of marriage until I read Spiritual Partnerships and saw that what makes the most sense is that we come here as souls on earth. Just like I go to set on day one for a new character, I show up, my character falls in love with this person. I play the love scenes and they're very sexy. You can YouTube them. But they're sexy, yummy love scenes.
Yeah,
and we go through the whole storyline but I don't think that Annalyn's now going to be with the guy. Like, I don't then get in his car at the end of the day while we're filming. He's like, lady, what are you doing? I'm like, well, it's forever, bitch. Like, you know,
right.
The idea that we would put onto ourselves the weight of forever and then punish ourselves when we fuck it up. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's actually like an attack waiting to happen on ourselves. And our my industry does it. The narrative of the actors and entertainers who play these characters, the press media, they do it. Mm-hmm. Our families do it. Every story we read.
I always feel like that's so interesting to talk about, like the different kinds of relationship models and like the way like cisgender, heteronormative, binary, monogamous relationships have become literally the law. And it's like,
so weird.
You look throughout history, it's like we've had all these things that were here all along. Women have been here the whole time, guys, but they only just got the right to vote a hot minute ago. You know what I mean? So it's like trans people have been here the whole time. Non-binary people have been here the whole time. Same-sex marriages and partnerships have been here the whole time. Yeah. It just takes a while for like mass consciousness to fully integrate it in a such way that it expresses through law, right? And so there's actually even a legislator, I'm not even going to say his name, in Texas right now that is on the record saying he wishes women couldn't initiate divorces.
What?
I know, exactly. So it's like, and so there's, and
I'm Googling his name right now. What's his name?
The truth is I can't remember it.
Oh, okay. Who is this fool? No,
we'll look it up after.
What in the world?
Exactly. And
what is the misogyny? Hell?
Plenty of other crazy things have come out of that guy's mouth too. And it's like, there's like a trend of it, you know, of like, just like some people are saying, like, you know, down with the patriarchy, there's people who are like, actually, bro, up with the patriarchy. You know what I mean? And really with what you're talking about, I remember, I so appreciate you talking about your early opinions and thoughts and perspective on marriage.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember when I was introduced to marriage, I also was like really curious about it and didn't fully understand it. And
I wouldn't say I was curious about it, but
well, I had a lot of energy on it too.
Yeah,
you know, and my
perspective, mine was deep disinterest, but
I had a lot of interest, but let me tell you why. I had the exact opposite approach. I was like, yes, marriage, hell yeah, please. Because I was raised not, you know, you kind of takes a while for you to really learn things in the world. So I didn't fully understand that Mormons don't practice polygamy, plural marriage anymore. But I was raised in a culture where, you know, Brigham Young was one of our ancestors, this really important figure, had 250 wives. And I didn't really know that you couldn't have multiple wives and husbands. I didn't know this. And so for me, I was like, marriage sounds great. I had like 33 husbands and 11 wives. Merit sounds great to me. Yeah. And then, you know, and I just kind
of. That's a decent ratio. I can work with that.
And I basically had this idea that, like, oh, marriages are sort of like things that come, you know, come in like other kinds of relationships where you have like deeper connections or whatever. And I clearly didn't understand the way the world
works.
Well,
it's interesting how my outlook on all of it evolved. And I remember coming in, running into my friends' houses and rooms and coming up with my newest philosophy on relational dynamics. Mm-hmm. And I came to my friend Colette's house one day and I was like, I no longer believe in monogamy. There's only 3% of animals on the planet that are monogamous and humans aren't one of them. Homo sapiens are incapable of monogamy. But it's interesting because I was doing that because I was afraid to admit that I wanted to be loved.
Right.
And for me, I am a hopeless romantic. I do want my knight on a white horse that comes in. And this idea of having a very alpha man so that I can just relax into my femininity and be in that. And it's interesting because I have a lot of friends who I've been friends with for a long time. And when I was super defensive and masculine and protective because of all my trauma, which is something that happens to the feminine. If the feminine feels under threat, she immediately shifts into a masculine energy typically. So I lived in that state for such a long time that I hardwired myself in a lot of ways to be in this masculine vibration. And when I started to shift out of that, I realized, oh my God, I'm going to attract beta men if I'm in alpha mode.
If you're top, you're attracting bottoms, baby.
Exactly. I don't mind getting on top, but I don't want to be the top. I want my man to be alpha. And because for the feminine, or at least for me expressing in that way, I know that I'm safe.
Right.
He's going to take the lead. If I don't agree, honey, gonna hear from me. But it's a different thing because if you're with someone who you trust and the alpha is the man and the man takes the lead, it's a wonderful thing.
Right.
This language is so triggering for people. And if my 20 years ago self or 10 years ago self heard me talking like this, I'd be like, oh my God, this pansy ass little feminine bitch. Oh my God, she looks like me. Is that me in the future? No, kill her now. You know, because I would have been so triggered by this man in a leadership role because it was abused.
Right.
In front of me in such a disgusting way when I was a child growing up with these families and these cultish dynamics where the male parent was just icky and gross and oppressive and dominating and domineering, and the energy was just disgusting. And these men were really pansy ass bitches, because real alphas, sorry, is that inappropriate to say? They were, though. They were real pansy ass bitches. Because real alphas don't need to prove anything. A lion doesn't need to walk around roaring. He roars once, your ass gotta run. Like, he's a lion.
When you see a lion,
he just walks in and he's a lion.
A lion will literally sit there and not disturb any other animals unless they're feeding. You know, the lion doesn't need to come kill that gazelle just because it can.
Yeah. During the heat of the day, he's taking a nap. Like he's rolled over like a big cat, just like your house cat. And that's the power of an alpha. And that kind of comfort in oneself is why the feminine feels safe with an alpha, the beta female, the feminine energy feels safe with the masculine or the alpha male. Mm-hmm. And, or at least that's what's true for
me. And everybody, yeah, exactly.
Because we all have those energies within ourselves.
Yeah, we all have them in like varying degrees. And so there's like, you know, partnerships that happen within that dynamic.
Well, and also, I mean, I also, whenever I say energies too, I know that my feminine is safe to free herself up because my own masculine is balanced now.
Mm-hmm.
My masculine was so out of balance that my feminine wasn't even allowed to ever pop up and say hi or without being shushed, you know? So I am in a space where I can actually attract what I would like, which is a man who is, able to hold more of the alpha energy so that I can exist within the feminine so that we have polarity. Mm-hmm. And when you find that, you know, you'll find that you don't have polarity. It doesn't matter what your gender is or your, who you are in the relationship. What matters is that you have opposing vibrational energy. So the masculine and the feminine are always going to be more polarized to each other. Mm-hmm. And that is more attractive typically, at least sexually. And it
expresses
that
in like all different kinds of ways too. Yeah. Like in the way you're like in an astrological chart, there's like all the different planets and all the different houses. It's like all these different subtle dynamics in someone's personality, you know, you can find your unique expression, you know, and I think it's really great that so many more people are really breaking the mold. And like someone told me a long time ago, and I was offended by it, but now I like use this expression. They said, "I love that you just let your freak flag fly." And I was like, "I don't have a freak flag. Thank you." Thank you so much.
Get after it. I have like, a mug for those of you listening. I have a mug that says "Get after it," and I felt like it was an appropriate time to bring that up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love hearing you talk about love and relationships, and of course, you have a lot of really interesting things to say about other things too. I like that, but I'm just like curious also about. You keep hinting that there's like this person coming. Is there someone that we can talk about or no?
Okay, I thought I was doing Modern Spirituality Podcast, not TMZ.
It's not TMZ energy.
Anyway, next question. Continue on, moving forward.
Okay. Well, what I just think it's really interesting that I really appreciate is how you're talking candidly about relationships, because I think that that's something that humanity hasn't figured out. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, I was in my 5-year on again, off again relationship. And we broke up one of the fucking 5 times or whatever. One of the 25 times that we broke up and got back together.
Well, you're the only one who's ever done that.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's unique to me.
Yeah.
Neurodivergent.
Terminally unique.
Yeah. So, but there was a woman who was actually, you know, quite a, you know, professional in the relationship field who I happened to like one synchronicity after another. She went to the wrong location, and the wrong location for her was the place I was going. And I happened to know her. She was going to the Den, the bar for a Christmas party. And I was doing a meditation class at the Den meditation. She showed up at the wrong address, walked in right when I finished the class, and I was having an emotional moment. And we had already met. We already knew each other. So she actually took me aside. We talked. I was like, I just went through a breakup. And she said this prayer for me. And one of the things she said that was so important for me to hear in that moment from a professional, from an elder, from like a mentor in the relationship space. I'll just say her name. Her name is Catherine Woodward Thomas. She wrote Calling in the One and Conscious Uncoupling. So I believe she's got a third one coming out. Can't remember the title. She'll be on as a guest sometime soon. But something she said to me was, look, the more honest and present you are in this relationship, the more that's just going into the collective, because none of us have really gotten this one figured out. None of us have really figured out relationships. And so that's why I'm bringing it up really, is because I think that it goes into the collective, like the unique.
I think that phrase is part of the, not that you misphrase anything, but that phrase in the collective consciousness is the problem,
which is
anybody figured it out. Nobody, you don't figure it out. You won't figure it out. You'll never figure it out. When you think you've got it figured out, then you level up and then you don't know anything about that level. And you have to die a million times on your Xbox game because you have to go through the level and learn the new figuring it out process. Right. So the idea that, and then if anyone's trying to sell you a figuring it out and arrive at a destination energy, you should walk away very quick, like moonwalk out of there. Because that's just not reality. We are on a spiral of elevation. And as we spiral up, we circle back over and again. You're not regressing. You didn't fuck anything up. You are revisiting from a step higher on that spiral staircase of your ascension into the highest you can be, if that's the process you're taking. Mm-hmm. And you don't figure it out. You will figure things out, and those will work in an individual dynamic. And then the dynamic could shift. And it's like titration with chemistry. You know, at any moment, you add any tiny droplet of something else. Now you got to figure something new out because it's an entirely different compound. So the idea that there's something that we can figure out can make us feel like we're never actually getting there. And it can be disheartening. It can make you feel like you want to give up. I had one friend who's my age, and I'm like, bitch, we ain't old. So why are you putting this out like you, this is your eulogy? But she was feeling a lot of energy in the world right now, but she was feeling like, is it too late for me? And I was like, huh? Hold up. Like, I'm literally 3 months younger than you. There's no too late for us. Okay. Like, calm down. So dramatic. But we did a meditation that I like to do with myself. And it's been a really helpful visualization process for me, but I also do it with my friends, especially in times like that, when my friend was sharing what she was sharing with me. And I asked her to close her eyes. And I said, I want you to just start to imagine and see yourself kind of in this safe space, wherever it is. It can be just the void or the abyss, or it can be a beautiful room, whatever. And I want you to see someone enter the space or come through the door, and it's you at 46, and then someone else comes and it's you at 56 and 66 and 76 and 86 and 96 and 106. I'm like, and now there's all these iterations of you. And you can do it right now if you're listening. And if you're not driving, if you're not driving, I invite you to close your eyes and just imagine you. And then 10 years, 20 years, 30 years older you, all these older yous coming in each decade. And they just grab your face and they say, you're doing such a good job. And I know it's so tough right now, but you figure it out. And then the next age says, and you know what? You figure out this portion too. And then 106-year-old you says, honey, we never figured it out, but that's okay. Right. And let that nurture and that nourishment and that truth sink and settle into you, that the you that is the youest you you'll ever be, which is you probably the day you take your final breath, it's, you're going to look back and everything was so silly and everything was so wonderful. Everything was so tragic and everything was so beautiful. Everything was so fearful and terrifying and scary. And everything was so filled with love and hugs and that warm, yummy embrace of the person or people that you love the most. You're going to have a dualistic outlook. So you're not going to have figured anything out. You're just going to have lived. And that's really all that matters, that you lived. But when you're trying to figure it all out, you're not living. You're trying. To try, to strive, to grasp is not to live. To live is to be. And coming back into the space of beingness, to be a human being, to be, is a lovely concept. Very hard to execute when you're hardwired from our culture and our society and our world to do. There's all those little like sayings like human doings, not human beings. It's, you know, it's problematic for you, but we then get caught up in the doing of life and the being stops, but we can create little awareness moments to check in. I would set like little alarms on my phone just in the beginning of my spiritual practice, like early days. I would just 15 minutes. Have I been breathing properly? A breath. Let's do a breath alarm. You know, like, have I been cycling on something? One single thought that's coming back repetitively over and over again. Okay. Let's look at that. And why are, like, can we release that? Can we detach? Can we have healthy non-attachment with that and with whatever that is. And these little alarms started to create little bells inside my brain. Then my brain started to be able to detect. The clearer I got, the louder these red flags became. Oh, resistances in my field. Like as soon as you and I weren't having a conversation about what I didn't like that you did, and I walked in the bathroom and my mind was silent again, I realized that, oh, that was really loud. There was a loud thing because my mind is normally silent when I'm alone. And the loud thing was, I didn't like what Ben said. And it was, what about it was, shush. What about it did I not like? And what does that say about me? What am I incapable of sitting with? I love Tara Brock. She says, can you invite it in for tea? Why could I not invite that moment in for tea? Why did it have to be so uncomfortable that I need you to change something that was what you wanted to do for me? Because I couldn't sit with it. I couldn't have it over for tea. I didn't want to be around it. I didn't want to be in the space of it. What does that mean? There's something there. There's a wound. There's a beginning point, an origin point that said, if this is happening, I'm not okay. What, whenever this happens, immediately not okay feelings should arise in my body, because if this is happening, I am not okay. And as soon as I told myself that that was a lie and that I wanted to release that origin wound with grace and that I didn't want it to ever come back and then I wanted to clear it from then to now, now to then, and everywhere in between, I was like, oh, okay. There was really no problem.
Well, and it's also really interesting. Like we mentioned the five love languages earlier, you know, it's like for me, I receive love through words of affirmation. Mm-hmm. So I am a words of affirmation person. So it's like, that's one of the things that I think is so interesting and important for me in my relationship. You know, we talked about yours, like mine, learning how other people receive love.
I scored 0 on words of affirmation.
I scored 100 on all of them. I don't remember what it actually was,
but 12, I was like,
I'm all of these corporates up and down, in and out.
Yeah. No, but I used to find words to be treacherous. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so when they were in the form of flattery, it was like, what do you want? What's your angle?
Right.
So that wound presented itself in your lovely, beautiful bathroom in there. And I realized that's a subjective belief based on my individual experience where I was treated in a way that made me distrust words. Mm-hmm. That is not Ben's experience. Hopefully that's not your experience, but that was my experience.
Yeah,
that was my experience. And in a dynamic with relationship, it is important that we validate, which we talked about, validate the discomfort someone's experiencing. But also going back to Gary Zukav, he always says, I'm going to be your spiritual partner, which means instead of saying the yummy, comfortable thing, I'm going to elevate. I'm going to challenge you to elevate in this space.
Right.
And the way he does that is not to tell you that you're wrong, which is what we had to work out. Because Ben went on to teacher mode. And I was like, I'm going to smack you, mother.
I didn't want to go into teacher.
No, but it's what people do. It's actually really relatable. We want to fix things immediately. Right. But what Gary suggests that we do to hold a space of humility so that someone can actually hear what we have to say, instead of offering a different perspective, ask, where do you feel this in your body? Mm-hmm. You're telling me that what I've said made you uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It's clear that that wasn't the intention. I know my friend Ben is not trying to make me feel uncomfortable ever. That's clear. I don't need to hear that right then. I need you to look at me and say, I'm so sorry you were uncomfortable. That was never what I ever want to happen to you. It'll never happen again. That's all I want to hear. I don't want to hear anything else. I just want to hear that, right?
Right.
But what Gary says to take it to the next level is, Annalyn, where are you feeling this in your body right now? Mm-hmm. And I was feeling it in my chest. It was tightening. I was wanting to protect and guard my heart. I was feeling tight in my chest, and the shallow breathing and discomfort originated in that way in my body. And then Gary would say the next step would be, have you ever felt this feeling before? Mm-hmm. Have you ever felt this feeling before in a circumstance that was different than this? Mm-hmm. And 10 times out of 10, you have. Right. 10 times out of 10, you felt your body feel this level of discomfort and it has nothing to do with what's being said in the moment. It has everything to do with an energy process that's going on in your body, where your body is saying, I don't like this. I'm supposed to feel uncomfortable. I feel uncomfortable. No, no, no. And that elevate. But the other interesting thing about focusing on the body is that if your heart rate accelerates and your stomach starts to feel that butterflies and whatever, you could have also won the lottery.
Right.
You could have won the lottery. Your heart rate will accelerate exponentially if someone tells you you just won the mega billions.
And when you have an orgasm.
And also that.
Your heart rate increases.
So the story attached to the nervous system's response is what Gary's trying to get to the bottom of.
Right.
What is the attached story? Because your nervous system is just telling you something it tells you all the time and could have any meaning you place on it. Mm-hmm. Right now, again, this can't be something that someone forces onto you. They have to do it gently. They have to do it with humility. They have to validate you because that's relationship duality. The duality is that there is the ego, and that's very real for people. And there's the divine self. Both are important. That's why we have them. So we validate the ego that you felt uncomfortable, but also can I take it a step further and talk to your soul? Is that okay with you? And if it is okay with you, can I ask your soul where in your body you're feeling this? It's a beautiful practice. And it just, you know, continues to go speak to the level of profundity that Gary has reached in interpersonal dynamics and shares that with us in such a beautiful way.
Yeah, I love that. And I just have to say, my bad. So
he looks so cute
when
he's apologizing.
Well, I just have to say, like, I just have to say, I never meant to make you uncomfortable ever.
Thank you.
I want to be like total safe zone, 100%.
Thank you.
And that's that.
We just had a moment, y'all.
And nothing's going to change ever with that. That's like the truth forever. And I'm learning through this moment because for me in that moment, you know, talking about your accolades and your past and like listing certain things, which is what you didn't like, which was the trigger, which went on too long.
Treacherous flattery words.
Which I know for me, it wasn't coming from a treacherous flattery place. For me, I think sometimes having worked with a lot of talent, having worked with a lot of, especially women in the entertainment industry, we were in a meeting with only men, and I have a pattern that I'm learning about and remembering, from when I had a female client in a meeting, of like often like really trying to like validate them or empower them or like reposition them in the meeting. Because I did feel like a lot of times the client, like we would kind of forget the value that she was bringing, or like we would talk about her like she wasn't smart, like she didn't have her own ideas and stuff like that. And so,
trust me, I wouldn't have been silent if that was what was going on.
So I think it's a pattern for me that comes from wanting to, that it's like one of those things where it's like the impact versus the intention. It's like it had a negative impact, but I had like an intention where I thought I was like doing something that was like going to create something good in the meeting dynamic or whatever.
You know?
So like, I think that when we were talking about it, I think that's why I glossed past what felt important to you, which is the important part you communicated is me stopping right then, hearing you, making it very clear that I'm listening and honoring and respecting what you're saying when you were saying it.
Right.
And in that moment, I was like, okay, that makes total sense. Not going to do that. But I said that in my
mind. Y'all, like if you're friends with your teacher, it gets convoluted.
I didn't mean to go into teacher mode. I think what happened was for me, it didn't feel like teacher mode. It felt more like publicist mode. It was like publicist from 15 years ago mode. It was like, actually everyone does need to know. You know, it's like there's like a part of me that like because I saw him come up too, and I was like, no, everybody needs to know everything you've ever done. but
we digress greatly.
Yeah, but I appreciate the authenticity, the transparency, and I definitely appreciate the actual experience because we're close friends, and how you feel matters to me, and how you feel is always going to matter to me, even if we're working together or in a private moment that's not work related or whatever. And and I'm just going to totally do better at that.
Oh my God. You're so sweet.
Look at that face.
Thank you. And this is how you do it, guys. This is it. This is what it looks like. It's not cute. It's messy. It's defensive. It's icky and yucky. And it's real. It's reviewing and evaluating yourself is all that matters, because whatever you're creating is for you. Whatever you're expressing is for you. The other person probably is halfway interested, but you are fully on board. You're fully on board with what you're there to say and do. And that I think is the part that we forget. It's like, I was yelling that I feel uncomfortable, but I felt uncomfortable because I had a belief that I didn't know I had that had extended for decades. And I got to release that because of this moment, because of what this moment has become, which is a teaching moment. And that then became all about me. It was only about me talking around in circles to me by using projection on you, so that I could get to that space where I needed to ultimately arrive at, which was that I didn't want to have this belief anymore.
Right.
Bye-bye belief.
Well, and I really respect your ability to say, like, wow, okay, you did the introspective thing. I respect your ability to do that. And I think we all need to do that. And at the same time, I'm going to do that also in the same dynamic, where it's like one person taking responsibility for their side doesn't negate what the other person can be learning too.
Yeah.
So it's like by the same token, it's like, even though for you, you initiated the conversation and you said,
so what does that look like? You were talking about your friend who's the author of Conscious Uncoupling. What does that look like when you're uncoupling?
Right. Well, I think it looks like, there's something that, as someone who's uncoupled a number of times,
But consciously and unconsciously are two very different ways of doing it.
Well, right. So what I see is, like, I think that's the main thing, is like, one, unconscious uncoupling would be, you know, you have a lot of fights, you know, and we would say,
why do you have the fights?
Well, I think they come up because sometimes relationships are supposed to transition, and we do have like a happily ever after story.
Right.
And it's a really strong one in the collective mind. And so I think that when a relationship is supposed to uncouple, or when we've outgrown something and our lives have something else for us, which I do believe happens, I think that it's really hard because we are told that we're supposed to fight to keep it. And maybe sometimes we are supposed to do that, but there's this idea that you have to 100% of the time fight, and this is the one that you're with is the one, kind of thing.
Right. Whereas another, just to continue to quote Gary Zukav, but another thing that Gary Zukav says is, you're not supposed to do what is said that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do the courageous thing. If the courageous thing for you... if the courageous thing for you is to fight, you should fight.
Right.
If the courageous thing for you is to walk away, you should walk away. The courageous thing is based on you, because if you always run from relationships, it's not courageous to walk away. You do that as default. It's courageous for you to stay and look them in the face and be honest and say, I still care about you. I don't want to lose this. I want to fight for you. If the courageous thing for you is if you always fight and you're like, I'm going to make you mine. Like, and the courageous thing for you would be to say, you know what? We've done everything we can, and it's time to call it quits. Then facing that elevates you as a being, and that is based on you. There is no right or wrong. There's no manual, but there is a right for you. And that's whatever the thing is that you likely don't want to do.
Right.
You're just resistant to.
It's the worst one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the one where you're going to come. For me, this is what it looks like. It looks like anything where I have to actually hurt somebody's feelings.
Which is so arrogant to think that you have that much power, Ben.
Totally. And it's a trauma response. It's literally like, don't hurt anybody. don't cause a ripple. Don't do the, be a good boy. Don't do anything wrong. Yeah, exactly. Like it's like that fawn kind of energy, you know, it's like that trauma response. There's like fight, flight, freeze, and fawn, where you sort of like fawn over someone and sort of like just want to like, it's a trauma response, but it comes off as being very caring or compassionate for another person. But really it's like,
it's hollow.
It can be a trauma response. Yeah. Hollow. Like there's like real empathy and real compassion. And I think real empathy and real compassion, especially in the context of uncoupling, I think has to, if I'm being honest, not that this is the fun or easy thing, because it's the courageous thing. I think it has to be where you like really trust God. You trust the universe. You trust that I'm going to be okay. You're going to be okay.
Yeah.
God is your mother. God is your father. You have like a mega heavenly trust fund. You know, you're okay. I'm okay. You're not, you know, as much as I don't want to say you're not my responsibility, because I think,
well, we're not responsible for people. We're responsible to them.
Love that distinction.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm. And so that's where it comes in. You got to be responsible. Thank you for that code, because it's being responsible to, it's like the namaste energy, like really respecting the other person's soul, you know? And then within that, there's like 1,000 conversations when you're, you know, depending on how enmeshed you are in the relationship, there's the unraveling of that can be time consuming and can be a lot harder than ghosting, can be a lot harder than not facing someone or.
I was literally the go-to ghost. Like, I'm just like, I'm just going to ghost, just go into the ghost realm. Goodbye.
I'll so see you next Halloween.
It's courageous for me to fight for someone, because I would run. I would hide. Okay. So what about if one party is wanting to consciously uncouple and then the other party wouldn't even consider the notion and probably vomits a little in their mouth at the thought of the phrase,
right?
Because it's like, so not their vibe. What does that look like? And I will just put my own thoughts for 2 seconds, please. Which is that there may be a tendency to think like, we're supposed to be unconsciously consciously uncoupling.
Right.
And how dare you not, which then just creates another fight to keep your relationship together.
Right. Because I thought we were going to do this consciously.
We're going to do this consciously. So what would be the ideal dynamic for someone who wants to maintain doing it consciously while navigating that the other person is not going to do that and has no interest in that and is probably going to throw, you know, every pan in the kitchen at you. What does that look like?
What comes up is like that Christ consciousness level bodhisattva, you know, it's like, I know that there's like something, there's an argument against what I'm about to say, but it's like, what I come back to is whatever the question is, the answer is, the divine. And so it's kind of like let's say you're going through a breakup and you're definitely breaking up. So it's not that one person is trying to keep the relationship, but it's one person doesn't want to do it consciously, wants to call you out big time, wants to rehash the flaws, you know, hold you accountable. They're pissed, you know, like I'm picturing that when you're talking about that. Mm-hmm. I see in those kinds of situations, which are really common, unfortunately, right? I think, the person who does want to be conscious, and I think in most situations it's you, listener, it's not the other person, right? It's you that wants to be conscious.
You're the conscious one.
You're the one that wants to do it. It's always us, not you. I'm not talking about you. Okay. So, but if we're the one that wants to be conscious in the uncoupling, I picture that bodhisattva consciousness, which is I'm going to survive this moment for the benefit of this larger process, for the benefit of all beings, for the benefit of my learning, for the benefit of this person's learning, which means patience and compassion. Mm-hmm. So just holding.
And for me, I would add that patience with yourself, compassion for yourself, and then think about the other person, because mm-hmm. you can't do anything for them if you don't offer that to yourself first. You will burn out with it, and then you'll become more unconscious during the uncoupling process than they are,
right?
Because it doesn't, you can't give what you don't have. It won't sustain itself. And you will resent that you even tried to do that ultimately. So it has to start with, it has to start with you.
Mm-hmm. Woo! That's some good stuff there.
Ah, I need some water.
I know, I need some after that too. I'll drink to that. Cheers.
Saúde.
Saúde. Totally appreciate that. Love everything that you're saying. I feel like we could go on and on and will, and I 100% want to invite you back and do this 10,000 more times. I love learning with you and doing life with you. Thank you so much. Big respect. Can we hear some of the stuff you have coming up?
Yes, I am working on a show right now. Of course, as soon as I move back east, they fly me back to LA to do a show here. Mm-hmm. But I have a film coming out that you came to set and visited me on.
Yes.
In September, I think premiere date is set for late September. Mm-hmm. And the film is called Condition of Return. I did not want to do this project.
Right.
I was incredibly reticent about taking this film. And I'm so glad that I was listening to my higher me, because my Mimi was like, nah, nope, right. Not trying to be in this. Nope, don't want this controversy. And it is a very controversial piece.
Right.
It's an independent. We put a lot of heart and soul and passion and love into it. But it holds one of the work days of my 20 plus year career that I didn't want to show up for work. Mm-hmm. And there were only two in my whole career, but that this film, one of those days was the day that I had to, as the character, I had to walk into a church with an AR-15 and fire 19 shots into the crowd.
Wow.
And I did not want to do it. And one of the heaviest days of my entire career for me, for the crew, for the cast, for the amazing background artists who were so wonderful and did such a good job, but it was so heavy. And then we all had to go home after filming that and turn on the news to discover that Uvalde had happened that day, the shooting in Uvalde. We came to set the next day and we all were really, really emotionally wrecked, knowing the importance of the film we were doing, but also just feeling the weight of all of what's going on in the world. And so I know that this was something I was supposed to do, mm-hmm. but I am scared. I'm scared of what this film is, because it's all too relevant and all too real. And my hope is that it takes that fear that I feel, and it's kind of pain that I feel. I hope it does something alchemical with it. I hope that we're able to transmute that. And I would love to see it be a conversation piece, that whatever comes of it, that we have something more of a conversation about what's going on in our world. And of course, mass shootings make up a very small portion of the deaths caused by weapons of a lot of destruction. Right. But the DOJ has been researching mass shootings. And actually, though our media doesn't like to put out to the world that it's anything other than more guns, no guns. And those are just the ridiculous. I'm a right. gun owner myself. I'm from Georgia. I don't see any problem with being a gun owner. I also never intend on shooting anybody with right. my gun. So I don't have an issue with, however we bring in every precaution and protect mm-hmm. to make sure that gun owners like me are the ones that are the ones with guns. President Obama said something really profound about this. He said that when we had car accidents happening, immediately it became car safety. Mm-hmm. Put seatbelts in. Seatbelts are required. You get click it or ticket, right?
Right.
Nobody protested and freaked out that we were saving lives by having you put your seatbelt on. People just started putting seatbelts and the car industry said, okay, if you sit in the front seat, because people in the front seat are most likely to get the most damage, right? If you sit in the front seat, we're going to make your car yell at you with an annoying, monotonous beeping sound because we care about you not dying.
Right.
We don't want to take on that liability that our car, you know, could have done more for you to save your life. So everybody came together on car safety, and it wasn't a big thing in the world, or in the world of America anyway. But when we talk about gun safety and we talk about for me, gun safety, what would fall under that isn't just, do I know how to place my gun in a locked box with the ammunition separate and all the things that you do, but, and away from children, but also this is my gun.
Right.
It's attached to me. Like, my car is registered to me.
Right.
I don't mind having registration and license and you get points on your license if you screw up. We should have a system that shows a regulatory process for gun owners, for our fellow Americans to know that just like when you get behind the wheel of a car, that you expect other people to stop at the red light because that's the law, that you don't do certain things with weapons around me where I feel unsafe in the world. So I hope that this film, and I appreciate the platform because we are doing just that. We're having a conversation right now about that. I hope that it inspires more conversation because there's a lot of themes in the film.
Well, I love just how you address it already, because you're not taking on one of the two mainstream media narratives.
Which you mean is, I'm not fringe?
You're actually what the mainstream media would, I think, paint as fringe, which is actually like a nuanced person who can say, yeah, you're right. A lot of people should not have these guns. Not everybody should have them, but we should also have guns. You know, and there's an interesting debate within, the political spheres around rights versus privileges. Driving is considered a privilege, whereas gun ownership is a Second Amendment right. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole conversation happening where people say there shouldn't be that kind of regulation because it's a right, it's not a privilege.
Right. But when that Second Amendment was put into place, we had some really sad versions of guns. You got to like stand there for 10 minutes and reload that shit. You know, like there was a different, it was a time when they couldn't have imagined what we have now.
Right.
I will not give up my gun. I'm an American and I have the right to bear arms and I will have my gun. I am very, very happy to own my gun. I like to go to the gun range and safely follow protocol and shoot at a gun range. I like that because I do that, I'm really good on camera with my gun training when I play characters who use weapons. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a detective who then doesn't know how to hold a gun. I like that I have a history of knowing how to use a firearm. Mm-hmm. So super here for that. I mean, I grew up with got the rifle in the backyard when the possum comes, you know, so I'm like, I literally it's a little sketchy, but I, that is my programming. So I hold a lot of space for rights and for the Second Amendment. I think that when we do this Wokeville versus red right fringe, we lose the truth.
Right.
And that's really all. So I hope that this invites truth into the conversation. And the DOJ is finding with their research that mass shootings are public suicides and that the shooters never intend on getting out alive or rarely ever intend on getting out alive. It is, if I'm an actress and I'm playing a character, which I do play a character walking into her circumstances are slightly different because this is also the world of entertainment. So we had to, you know, make it as fictional as possible. But if I'm a character who's going in for that purpose, I'm going to think about what is her psychology? She has felt invisible her whole life. Of course, in death, she wants to be as visible as possible. So I would deeply request federal legislation that says it is disallowed by the U.S. government to mention the name or show the face of the shooters. Don't give them a legacy, because this will maybe stop their suicide, but certainly help reduce mass shootings from occurring. If the whole point is that you get seen, and we don't ever mention your name, and we never acknowledge you, and they never see other shooters get acknowledged all over every news outlet all day, every day when a mass shooting happens, mm-hmm. it might deter people who are looking for that boost as they go out.
It's so important that you say that, because I think that for you say it like it's common sense. You say it with such conviction and confidence, it makes a lot of sense. But the thing is, I think that for you, it feels like common sense because of your experience playing the villain and getting into the mindset of like what that villain wants. But many people just look at a villain and they say, that person's bad. That's a bad guy. Like Little Mermaid just came out. Ursula, it's like, we're going to need another Ursula movie to be able to see how she became Ursula, just
like Wicked for
Wizard of Oz, Maleficent for the Sleeping Beauty story.
Angelina and Maleficent.
She was amazing. Exactly. Oh. Yeah. So there's something really interesting about how there's like an immature psychology concept where we want to shame somebody and we think that that's going to get them to not do it. But some people actually get off on the attention, you know, and there's even like white supremacist organizations that you get in by killing somebody. Ugh. You know, and there's gangs that are you get in by killing somebody. And so even like the press that you would get from that serves as, you know, some kind of benefit.
Right.
You know. And so but it comes from this desire to shame, where it's like, this is the bad guy, like bad, look at this person, shame on them. They shouldn't have done this, you know, but you're actually right. It's not causing less of them to happen. If anything, no. It seems like more of them are happening.
Yeah.
More copycats, more ideas. I mean, I remember that first one, years ago in Littleton, Colorado, that first shooting sort of wasn't truly the first one. It was sort of the first big one maybe in our lifetime that really like hit the news. Mm-hmm. And I remember they talked about the kids that did the shooting, and they called themselves the Trenchcoat Mafia. And it was very much like these were kids that felt othered, that didn't feel included, that went out with the bang, you know, like you were saying.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's kind of interesting that even on this other level, there's this huge, and it reminds me of something in A Course in Miracles. An action is either an expression of love or a call for love.
A call for love, yeah. A friend of mine on his news show, he always says, this issue is not going to be solved because the problem is more beneficial than the solution to the players who are using it.
Wow.
And he's right. He's right, because both we have this terrible thing that George Washington never wanted, which is the two-party system, the left and the right against each other. To solve this issue would be to reduce something they can yell from a microphone about. Mm-hmm. So the problem benefits them more than the solution.
Right.
And he said that about, you know, many things, that clearly the solution for car safety was beneficial for everyone. No one batted an eyelash, and we have safer cars and safer
ways. There's also a time before the level of lobbying that we have today.
Right. Which is another thing. It was in the time.
Really, it wasn't down for that big cost increase. You know, if that happened today, we would have lobbyists be like, we don't need to increase the cost of cars. You know how expensive cars are? No one can afford cars already.
Right.
You know, they even tried to do the smog tests. They don't want you to be required to do a smog check Basically because it requires them to construct the vehicles in ways that are going to actually sustain.
Yeah. If you Google the lobbyist salaries and you see the highest level salaries, about like, you know, $500,000 plus for a lobbyist are typically pharmaceutical, medical, and you make a lot of money for getting in the faces of our state representatives and, and saying whatever you're saying to benefit whomever you're benefiting. And a lot of times it's are kind not of like actors. Liars. a lot of the people that are being impacted in a positive way aren't a lot of the people.
Right.
It typically is a small number. So I think with this film, which touches on that, it touches on how this young woman got into this position. So it starts at the middle of this and kind of tracks backwards in flashback. But she also is perpetrated upon by another massive organized situation in our world, and deep pause for the word I'm searching for. I'm like, organized crime? No.
Yeah.
Religions that benefit from problems over solutions.
Right.
Can cause the individual to do many things. We see radicalism all the time. We don't think of it in terms of the bigger religions, except when it's Muslims.
Right.
It's like, except when it's Islam, and then it's like, you know, no, you're that suddenly that's, you know, that has been attacked in such a horrific way. And I remember spending time in Morocco, and security that we had there was a practicing Muslim, and at a time when our country is just being so nasty towards that beautiful religion. And I asked him, I was like, Raheed, will you tell me about being a Muslim?
Mm-hmm.
And he let me ask him all the questions, and I was probably inappropriate and probably asked things that were not politically correct to say, but he was so gracious. And I said, okay, so here's another question. This was one of the big ones, and I didn't know how to say it. And he just like, ask me anything. It's okay. I'm not judging you. This is the way of Islam, is compassion, is peace. And I said, so why do you wear shorts and a shirt? It was hot, it was summer, you know. But we obviously were facing individuals who were wearing, you know, full beard, and he was clean shaven, and the women in the burqas and the hijabs. And I was like, what's different for them than you, and you than them? Like, what are these different? And he was giving me information about the different. Mm-hmm. He's like, there's a show of piety, and it's important within the Muslim community. And I had such a backwards concept of this, right, this way, because I'd only seen US media and how they've bastardized a very old, beautiful religion with wonderful teachings within it. And yet we protect Catholic priests who are abusing children, and the Catholic Church that in my state, in Georgia, the year that I remembered my childhood memories of sexual abuse, there was some good lobbying going on for a bill to be passed to lengthen the time that an individual like me, who remembers late their memories because their brain protected them, that extended about two decades the time.
Wow.
Do you want to know who helped fund fighting against that bill being made into law?
Wow.
The Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts of America. There was an article on this, and they were alleging all of this. And I sat there reading this, and that someone literally was fighting against me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a of religion. Mm-hmm. And you have beautiful, wonderful people who follow the Catholic faith, right, and are so giving, the Mother Teresa's of our world, that like these wonderful places that take in individuals in at the border, the Catholic churches are taking in the refugees and just no questions asked, holding space for moms and kids and creating safety. And then you got at the organized level, at that really high top tier, this nasty energy. And so, you know, I think that the film touching on beliefs within this young woman's faith, she happens to be Catholic. She's not allowed to do certain things because she's devout. And the one incident that leads to everything is her having a little bit too much fun in a bar one night, meeting a cute guy, having fun with him in the bathroom. Very good Catholic girl. Good job keeping the stereotype alive. But she gets pregnant and she's not allowed to have an abortion because her faith says she can't. Mm. And she's not ready to have the child and she can't not have the child. Mm. And I personally, like, for my own reasons and my own quote unquote faith in things, my mother was a failed abortion. So I personally would never have abortion, but I would never dare to look at another circumstance and not offer 100% support in whatever a woman chooses to do with her own body. But my character, that wasn't even a question. That is a no zone. You cannot do that. It is not allowed as per the Catholic faith. And that single event that led all the way to the first scene of the movie that would then be the end of the movie, her walking into a church with an AR-15 and shooting up the congregation, could have been avoided.
Right.
if she had the compassion and the love that's taught within the Catholic faith and perhaps less of the rigidity.
Right.
This is a 17-hour podcast. I'm so sorry.
Well, I mean, I so appreciate everything you just said, because it's like everything that comes together in a film. That's what I love so much about film, and being able to go see and have like the immersive experience of something and see the different sides of something. You're bringing a white Catholic Christian girl who is experiencing things that many Americans are experiencing. She goes through an extraordinary trauma that's already hard without the extra storylines and extra pressure that, you know, religious literalism has placed over it, you know, already a hard experience, pushes her past the level. And she has like easy access to this huge automatic rifle, takes out lots of people before any intervention can really happen. And I mean, the fact that you're addressing trauma, toxic theology, and even mass shootings, gun reform, all in one film is like hugely impactful. And then the nuance that you're navigating those issues with is also really, really potent, because we're used to, that's how I can tell, of course, I already know you and everything, but that's how we can see the authenticity of your relationship to these issues versus, you know, you choosing a party line and having, you know, claiming one of the more convenient polarized perspectives. You could sit here and be like, you know, this means all guns have to be taken off the market, you know.
Yeah.
And but you're saying like, hey, you know, can we actually honor the Second Amendment and also like update to the reality of the circumstances of today and the technology we have? You know, you brought up registering the car and things like that. You know, I'm sure you wouldn't mind doing a background check.
You can face scan me. You can fingerprint me. You can put me in the system. I don't care. I don't ever intend on using my weapon to hurt any being on earth ever. That is never my intention. I am grateful to be a woman who lives alone and owns a gun. And also, I never want to fucking use it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when I think about that, I think about, you know, for me, I don't own a gun, but I was raised, I've got four brothers, and my dad taught every single one of us to load a gun, clean a gun, and shoot a gun.
Yeah.
And we're
damn good at it. Every single one of us is a damn good shot. Okay. You know, so it's like the thing, I relate to it too. I relate. It's like, it's like, I see how much I learned about safety and how much I learned about discipline and so many different things through the process of having a gun. I'm not going to hunt anything. People can hunt, you know, it's not really my thing.
I just had a flash of trying to imagine you hunting, and
I'd be like, don't hurt it.
The image in my mind just got, just started to distort.
Yeah, like I can't,
does not play, compute.
Can't even play a hunter on
does
TV.
Does not compute. Yeah, I definitely
probably could.
Yeah,
I could play on TV, but not gonna kill
it. It's not real.
Not gonna kill it. Yeah, exactly.
You could play CIA.
That's what I really want to play, CIA.
Yeah.
So if anyone in the agency is listening, I'm available for recruitment. I can keep a secret
on this very public podcast.
They're gonna think, everyone's gonna think I'm joking. No one's gonna think it's serious. That's the magic, right? Well,
now we know that too.
Yeah, see, that's the strategy. They still think of her. Okay, this has been amazing. Congratulations on the second season of Second Chances. That's yes. We are here in town filming yes. this week. And so that's great. And super excited about Condition of Return, which comes out in September. And yeah, I love everything that you're doing. Love the work that you're doing. Love the way that you share your healing journey. Thank you so much. Let's do it again.
Let's do it again.
Peace.
Hey, it's Ben Decker. And I just have to thank you again for listening to the Modern Spirituality Podcast. For information on anything mentioned here, you can check out the show notes below. You can also get in touch with me via twitter.com/BenDecker. Instagram.com/BenjaminWDecker or email me at BenDecker@ModernSpiritualityPodcast.com. It really does mean so much to me that you're here with me on the modern spirituality journey. I'm genuinely super excited about what I've got planned for these next few episodes. So really make sure to subscribe to the Modern Spirituality Podcast so you can get in on what I've got coming up. And if this is resonating for you, if anything here helped or inspired or entertained you at all, please, please do rate this podcast and leave me a review. It means so much more than you might realize. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again.